Hey everyone, this is Jillian and I am here with my friend Brittany. Hey Brittany.
Hey Jillian.
Welcome to Sidebar, where we're going to be chatting about Court Junkie episodes, other cases we're following, and basically all things true crime.
All right. And so today's show, we're going to discuss some behind the scenes info from the Ty Chan case, Sandra Melgar, Lori McConnell, and Kale Fleischauer cases. And we're going to get some updates on cases covered in the past, like a case with Alexis Murphy and Joel Guy Jr. And we'll talk about the cases that we're currently obsessing over, which I know we're both very excited about this segment today. And we'll talk about the murder of Kevin Jiang. Jillian was able to get an interview with somebody from the Yale Daily News who happens to be her cousin. And then we'll talk about some listener submissions on how they knew that they were court junkies. So we talked about this last episode and asked for your stories. So we have a couple of fun ones there. So with that being said, let's get right into it. So the first case that we're going to talk about is the deputy. So this case was Ty Chan in October of 2014. Two deputies with the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office left for Arizona on a work trip. After a night filled with drinking and arguing, only one would return home alive. So ultimately, Ty Chan was tried twice for the murder of Jeremy Martin, both ending in mistrials. And Chan maintained his innocence. He claimed it was self-defense. So Jillian, I'm going to just ask you right off the bat, was this self-defense in your opinion?
In my opinion, it's hard to believe his story of self-defense. From where I'm sitting, I just don't know that his actions fit his story. The fact that he chased him, the victim ran into the elevator and ultimately went down to the lobby. So it kind of suggests that he was running away from Ty Chan. I was a bit mixed on this one, but definitely leaning more towards a guilty verdict. Having said that, I'm not sure that, because we've talked in the past before about whether you actually believe that somebody is guilty versus whether there's enough evidence to prove that. So right. I don't know how I would have voted as a juror necessarily without being there in the courtroom, but I think personally, I do lean towards guilty. What about you?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And a couple of your listeners had left comments on Instagram, which got me thinking, if Ty Chan was not a deputy, would this have ended in the same way? I think definitely not. And so that doesn't sit well with me. Do I think that he was a cold-blooded killer who just wanted to murder his coworker? I don't. I think that there was just too much alcohol involved. It clouded a lot of judgment. Whatever argument they had was probably escalated. And it was just a very unfortunate ending to what was, you know, started off as a night fun, laid back, out of town, having a few drinks.
Yeah. And so one thing that I didn't include in the episode, and this goes along the lines of whether or not we think he's guilty or not guilty, was some of the members of the jury spoke out after that second mistrial about their deliberations. And I always think that it's interesting to get insight on what the actual jury was thinking, especially in a case like this one. They said at the start, there were three members who wanted to convict him of first-degree murder, but the others were not convinced. So then they moved on to second-degree murder. Five jurors then voted guilty for second-degree murder. By the time they had moved all the way to the lowest possible charge of voluntary manslaughter, they were split 6-6. There was some reporting that none of the jurors wanted to convict him of first-degree murder, but the jury members who spoke out said that that was not true, that there was one juror who the entire time agreed with the first-degree murder charge. Now, the jury members who spoke out said that they immediately knew that they would be divided and that they would likely never be unanimous. And I think that is definitely something that you saw in listener reactions to this case as well. So the jury members said that they felt horrible for both families. One even told the Sun News that she was sick to her stomach over it. And again, like I said, I always find it interesting to see afterwards, to see and hear from the jury and what they were thinking. And it just solidifies the fact that being a juror is extremely hard. Have you ever been on a jury, Brittany?
I have not. I have really wanted to be called upon, but I think the work that I'm doing with you here and covering these cases has me changing my tune there. I don't think that I would want to be responsible for that, especially in a case like this.
Yeah. I mean, so I've actually, believe it or not, I have also never been a juror. I have responded to jury duty and, you know, wanted to get on a case, but then the case was resolved before they even called us in to question us. So I think that happens a lot when you get called for jury duty. So yeah. And then I haven't heard from them in years. So I too have never served on a jury, but I always think about what a burden that must be afterwards. You know, you have to live with the decision that you put forth and, you know, that ultimately affected somebody's life forever.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. It's heavy. Okay, so let's jump into home invasion or murder from the inside. So this was the Sandra Melgar case. And this case, it was picked apart for years, still being picked apart. Lots of questions here. So December 2012, Houston police respond to a brutal murder scene. Jim Melgar was found dead in his bathroom and his wife of 32 years, Sandra, was tied up in the bathroom closet. Sandra told investigators that she had suffered a seizure and didn't know who killed her husband and locked her up. Investigators didn't believe her. Pretty immediately, she was the number one suspect. She was charged and later convicted of his murder. So is Sandra a cold-blooded killer or an innocent person in prison? Jillian?
First of all, Matt Kaiser is one of my writers, and he's written a couple of episodes for Court Junkie before. The one that comes to mind is the wrongful conviction case he wrote about Lydell Grant. So Matt came to me and pitched the Sandra Melgar case, which I had absolutely heard about, but I just always knew that it was a very popular case that a bunch of other really great true crime pods had covered. So I basically kind of stayed away from it, just knowing that other podcasts and documentaries have covered this. Do I really have anything to add? But Matt was interesting because he had covered the case for KHOU, which is a local news station over there. And he had even produced and hosted a podcast about this case for that same news organization. So I gave him the go-ahead and I was really pleased with his write-up. I did make a few additions to it because, you know, whenever a writer of mine turns in a script, I'll go through it, fact check it, do some of my own research and make any additions I find. And I did find some court documents with some extra details in them. So I added those in there. The thing about this case is that it is such a complicated case and it is one where everybody has an opinion after listening to it. As you know by now, those types of cases are my favorite, where they're not so cut and dry and there's lots to discuss. And so that's how the Sandra Melgar case came to be. So what were your thoughts on hearing this one?
I try not to get too caught up on one single piece of something because obviously you have to look holistically at all of the evidence that is presented. But one thing that bothered me was evidence that was not presented, and it was the bloody fingerprint that was found on the safe. So I think it would be, if that was tested and that was a unknown person's fingerprint, I think that would have been huge for the defense. If it was Sandra's, which I can't imagine a situation where she would have murdered her husband and tried to get into her own safe, then that would have taken it a different direction as well. So I think that there was a misstep in not testing that. And so that stays with me. There also, and some of your listeners had pointed this out too, is that it just seemed so lacking any motive. They were married for 32 years. It didn't appear that they had any financial problems, any infidelity, that they got along well. So the prosecution really based their case on she was getting after the life insurance money. And so that for me wasn't enough. I don't agree with the jury's decision based on the evidence that was presented.
I agree. I mean, honestly, I feel like the majority of my listeners also said the same thing, right?
Yeah. So 31% said guilty and 69% said not guilty.
Right. And so because, you know, it's just a podcast and I only basically do 45 minutes to about an hour, sometimes a little over an hour episodes. There is a lot of information in this case. And I do want to shout out some other podcasts that have covered it. I have not admittedly listened to the coverage surrounding it, but I do know that Missing Pieces, The First Degree, Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff, I guess, did a very extensive series on it too. So I just want to shout out those podcasts if anybody is interested in, you know, hearing even more about this case. And I'm sure there's even more than that too. There's just lots and lots of info out there about this particular case.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if anything happens further with this or if she's just going to sit and do the time.
Kathleen Zellner, you know, just taking over the case too. She's always one to watch with the wrongful conviction cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with her representing, I don't think that'll be the last that we hear of this one. So any updates, we'll be sure to give you those. So let's talk about Lori McConnell. Obviously, this was a really sad case. So Lori was shot and killed with her friend in an ambush-style attack from an abusive boyfriend. And she had a very long history of domestic violence with said boyfriend. Lori tried several times to leave. She tried to get help from domestic violence advocates. Her family tried to help her, but ultimately the system failed her. And unfortunately, she lost her life in this. And so this touched, I think, a lot of your listeners and made people very sad about the situation. And so we'd love to hear from you, Jillian. You know, why did you pick this episode to talk about? And what were some of the listener reactions that you got from it?
So this is a case that's one of those that will be near and dear to my heart forever. So Ryan Van Doren reached out after I released episode 100. And episode 100 was about this girl named Rebecca whose father murdered her grandparents. And that episode was just such a personal one. And I know that I was really touched by it. And I think that Ryan was too, because he emailed me shortly after that about his mom's case. So this was actually early last year, and I immediately filed a Freedom of Information Act request for more information on the case, and then COVID hit. And so everything kind of came to a standstill. So it took a while, but we were able to get enough information about it. And then Gabrielle Rousson, another one of my writers, interviewed Ryan and his sister, Laura. And when I listened to their interviews, I was in tears. Like, I was so touched by the way in which they spoke about their mom and how horrible what happened to her was. I felt like I could feel their pain and agony and sometimes even guilt through my speaker. I was actually so moved at one point that I found myself emailing Ryan like this super mushy email, thanking him for sharing his story and, you know, telling him that I know it's going to help somebody listening, whether they could identify with his mom or with them, you know, with having a family member in such an abusive relationship. I just thought it was really powerful. And I think Gabrielle, my writer, did an excellent job in capturing the story. And the interesting thing is that since that episode was released, I have received numerous emails and messages from people who said that they could relate and who shared their own stories with me. So it's just been kind of an emotional past month, just sort of interacting with these listeners and hearing their own stories. And I've no doubt this episode is definitely going to lead to future episodes with more topics such as this one, because I think it's important to talk about these things and to provide sort of a community and to just be there for survivors of this sort of thing.
Now, do you feel like the authorities have any responsibility here because her boyfriend was let out of custody after he had attacked her? Was it 2 days after he had attacked her that he was let out and really able to then commit this murder?
Right. I don't know if it comes down to the local authorities. This is an issue that I think kind of goes into the criminal justice reform umbrella, the fact that he was able to post a relatively low bond, or his family members were, and he was able to get out of jail. And like you said, then go on to murder his victim. So there's the question about that. There's the question about, you know, the restraining order. Does that even do anything? You know, I mean, he was able to find out where she was that night. She was just out with some friends. As Ryan said, she was like trying to get her life back. And, you know, it's just tragic all around. I think that there's a lot of missteps in this case. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly who bears the responsibility. But this can't happen. This can't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody is threatening you and is abusing you, there just has to be more resources for victims and there has to be more protection for victims. This is not something that should be the norm in this country.
Okay. Well, let's move to our last case that we're going to go over, which was the death of Chase Fleischauer. So in April 2018, Chase and Summer went to go visit their father for the weekend. After a night of sitting around and drinking, Chase is found shot and killed in the home. So his father, Cale, was ultimately tried and convicted for his murder. Did the jury get it right? So Jillian, what do you think?
I think they did. So I've been working on this case for quite some time, actually. I think I started it at some point last year. And when I watched this trial, I was really moved by Summer Fleischauer's testimony and how brave she was to testify against her own father. I cannot even imagine how hard that must have been. I was pretty into this case because for me, it all came down to the distance of the gun from Chase's body, which was a little more than 10 feet. Now, the defense said in the first trial, and this wasn't in the episode, but that Cale's dog could have moved the gun. And that was actually the experiment that the juror tried and how it led to that initial mistrial. Because obviously, as a juror, you can't go home and conduct your own experiment. But in this second trial, the prosecution pointed to the distance as proof that Chase didn't shoot himself, whether accident or otherwise. But the defense brought up an expert who happened to be Cale's friend, which is another interesting aside, who testified that he conducted an experiment and that the gun could have recoiled that far. So it's one of those where the credibility of the witnesses comes into play and, you know, you have to decide who to believe. Personally, I think the prosecution was absolutely correct on this one. I think Cale was completely wasted. That part was not in dispute. I think they got into a fight and Cale was angry and went and got his gun. And it's awful that a father could do that to his son. I can't even imagine, but that's my opinion on it.
Yeah. And the majority of your listeners agreed on Instagram. I think it was 8% not guilty and 92% guilty. So I think of the polls that you've done, that was the most overwhelming. So I'd be interested to hear the side of the 8% who don't think that they got it right. I know that in your episodes and right now, we're talking really about the evidence that was presented at trial, but I just can't get over that recording, the body cam recording of Cale making jokes and laughing and being really just very disturbing behavior while your son is still laying there dead. You know, again, as you said, I think the drinking, his mind state was completely altered. And it was just a tragedy for sure. All right. Well, that's it for the episodes from this month. So let's talk about some case updates. Jillian, you have a couple for us. We're going to start with Alexis Murphy, right?
Yes. I covered this case back, you know, this was episode number 7. So I believe this would have been back in 2016 or so. Alexis was 17 years old when she disappeared in 2013. I spoke with her aunt in the episode and we discussed Alexis's disappearance as well as the conviction of Randy Taylor, who was convicted of her murder. This was my first no-body murder case. And now, sadly, her body has been found. She was found on a private property in Livingston in December 2020. And authorities just confirmed that it was her in February 2021. They also stated that the case is now finally closed. Her family provided a statement, and I just want to read the statement. And it said, "Our family is so grateful for the continuing love, support, and prayers for Alexis and our family over the past 7 years. While we have been grieving the loss of Alexis since 2013, we remained hopeful that she would be found alive and well. Alexis was the fashionista, athlete, and joker of our family. We were blessed to have loved her for 17 years, and her memory will continue to live on through us all. Our family would like to extend a heartfelt thanks and sincere gratitude to the citizens of Nelson County, the FBI, the Virginia State Police, the Nelson County Sheriff's Office, and all of the search and rescue teams for your commitment and unwavering support to find Alexis. You all kept the promise made in 2013 to bring Alexis home. During this time, we ask that you continue to lift our family up in prayer, and in the words of Alexis, keep hope alive. Respectfully, the family of Alexis Murphy. So definitely some sad news. It was an outcome I think everybody who heard about this case was probably expecting, didn't want to hear, obviously, but best thoughts, wishes, and everything goes out to the family of Alexis. So then another case update we had just talked about in the last sidebar episode, the Joel Guy Jr. case, which also elicited tons of reactions from listeners. Listener Amanda tipped us off to this one. His team filed a motion for a new trial, claiming that he didn't receive a fair trial due to the pandemic, and he's requesting a new trial. So I think that's interesting. I don't know that he will get a new trial. And even if he does, I think the evidence is pretty clear that he did commit the crime. But I am interested to see how many motions like this we're going to see of defendants claiming that they didn't receive a fair trial due to the pandemic. So definitely something to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, that's what I thought too when I saw that. This is going to be a great excuse for a lot of people. And also, you know, getting out of jail early because of COVID or delayed trials because of COVID. It's obviously just something that's impacted every single aspect of our lives.
Right. And, you know, there may be some merit to that because I'm not really sure how witnesses may have been affected. I mean, who really knows? Are they definitely getting a fair trial? Do we know that for sure? Or is, like you said, this could just be an excuse too. It's probably going to have to be on a case-by-case basis, I guess.
Well, before we jump into our cases that we're obsessing over, you did have a bonus episode this month, right?
I don't want to give anything away, but I think it's a really good one out of Florida where the killer is someone you would likely least expect. So as a reminder, I do put up bonus episodes each month on Patreon for listeners who donate $6 or $10 a month. To check any of that out, just go to courtjunkie.com/support and you can see everything there.
Okay, so let's jump into the cases that we are currently following, currently obsessing over. Jillian?
Yeah, so one case that I've been following, and I know a lot of other people have as well, is the murder of Kevin Jiang, who is a grad student from Yale. So I'm particularly interested in this case because my younger cousin, Valerie, is a junior at Yale. And so naturally, when I heard that a shooting had happened there, you know, my thoughts immediately went to her. Valerie is the university news editor at the Yale Daily News, or YDN, as they call it, and she and her colleagues have been covering this case. And so I asked her if she could share with me some more information about it. Now, I spoke with Valerie this past Friday, and there has already been an update since I spoke with her, which I will go over after I play this interview. I also want to make sure I throw this out there. Valerie is speaking to me as a cousin and not on behalf of the Yale Daily News. Let's talk a little bit about what happened on February 6th, 2021 and how this was initially reported.
Yeah. So basically from the perspective, you know, from my Yale student perspective, we got an email late that night, I think, from the chief of the Yale police, Ronell Higgins, saying that somebody had been shot near Yale's campus. And, you know, I didn't really think anything of it because we don't get news of shootings too often, but like someone is mugged or if there's some other like incident, then we'll get an email. And so I was kind of like, well, that sucks and that's too bad, but I'm still going to go to bed. But then I woke up to an email that was basically saying, you know, we are mourning the death of Kevin Jiang. And it went from there. And I woke up also to lots of texts and messages from my reporters and from my editors saying like, you know, we have to get the story out. So basically, I think it was around 8:30 p.m. Kevin Jiang was outside near his fiance's house and black car pulled up. Eventually, neighbors heard shots fired. Somebody told the police that around maybe 7 shots were fired. First responders tried to revive Jiang, but he was pronounced dead. Later on, it was said that He was shot multiple times at close range, and then a black car was seen fleeing the scene.
And how was this initially reported? Because I know there was a lot of talk initially about it being potentially a road rage incident.
Yeah, so we heard that it could have been road rage. I don't know exactly like which outlets. I know that the New Haven and Yale police were pursuing a variety of leads. So, but eventually on February 8th, the police announced that it looks like Jiang had been targeted.
Got it. And can you describe a little bit about the area where this happened? I know you say sometimes there's muggings and things like that, that a shooting was definitely out of the ordinary. But if you could talk a little bit about that area, and then how far is it from Yale?
New Haven is pretty much usually described as a dangerous city, just like, you know, by word of mouth. But it's, you know, it depends on the area. I'm from Chicago, and, you know, I never had any problems, but it depends on where you live. And so the shooting happened at the intersection of Nash and Lawrence Streets, which is a few streets away from like the very edge of campus. It's in an area where a lot of graduate students live, and actually where a lot more undergrads live right now, just because with COVID, a lot of people moved off campus. And so, you know, it's a pretty quiet area. We don't usually hear of crimes happening in that area, which is why I thought like initially, like, oh, like that's super strange. Because usually like you'll get notices of muggings or of armed robberies, you know, on other sides of the city closer to the downtown area.
And who was the victim in the case, Kevin Jiang? Do you know much about him?
I didn't know him personally, but I had some friends who did, and I also was the editor on his obituary for the YDN. And so Kevin Jiang was a student at Yale School of the Environment. He was set to graduate in 2022. And before he came to Yale, he was a member of the National Guard. I believe he served as both an environmental scientist and a tank operator. He was also a member of Yale's Christian Union, which is a major like Christian group on campus. He volunteered. I remember I looked at his Instagram, you know, after I heard of the news of his death, and he seemed like a very loving guy. And there were pictures of him with friends of mine. And it was also doubly sad because he would have turned 27 on February 14th, and he had proposed to his fiance the week prior to when he was killed.
Oh, that's so sad. How did the story of what happened start to evolve? So I know you said initially it went from like a road rage potential type shooting, and then, you know, to someone being wanted for questioning. How did that all come about?
Like, things evolved very quickly. So we went from knowing nothing on the night of the murder to February 8th, when the police said that it looked like Jiang had been targeted. And then soon after that, it was announced that a man named Keen Swan Pan was now a person of interest.
And do you know very much about Keen Swan Pan?
So it's, you know, we know basically what you can find on the internet, but basically he was born in Shanghai, or he's from Shanghai. He currently works as a researcher at MIT. And it was also interesting because he was Facebook friends with Jiang's fiancée, Zion Perry.
Mm, interesting. So do you know if police have any ideas of where they're looking for Pan and where he was last seen?
So on the day of the shooting, he had stolen a vehicle in Massachusetts. And he had apparently, and this just came out, I think, 2 days ago, he changed the plates on the car on the day of the shooting. And he was last seen at a Best Western in North Haven, Connecticut. So I'm in New Haven, so North Haven is just north. And it was interesting because police actually questioned him after he was reported having acted, and this is a quote from one of our articles, acting oddly in the vicinity of a suspicious vehicle, but they actually left him. And so now, last I heard, police don't think he's in Connecticut. They're working with the FBI and the U.S. Marshals to find him. And they're offering $10,000 for information that leads to his arrest. He's considered armed and dangerous. And then one also interesting point is that according to ABC News, officers had gone to his residence in Massachusetts several times for mental illness issues.
Just so I make sure I get the timeline of this correct. So basically on the day of the shooting, before the shooting is when he stole a car and switched the plates on it. Is that right?
Yeah, he switched the plates on the day of the shooting. Yeah.
Okay. And then when was he questioned about, when was he acting odd? Was that after the shooting?
Yeah. So according to the chief of the New Haven police, Pan became a person of interest following the shooting. So he was at a Best Western hotel in North Haven when the police were called. But after they questioned him, they ultimately left.
So what is some of the latest information, if you know of anything, that you can share about this case?
Yeah, so the most recent thing I already mentioned, we just found out basically that he had changed the plates on the stolen car on the day of the shooting. And it's also interesting, according to a family member, he also changed his cell phone number before going to Connecticut.
What are some of the rumors going around in the area? Like, what do people think happened? Like the why, the motive, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so right after the shooting, we were all pretty shocked. But then as things came out, we learned that Tan was friends with Jung's fiance on Facebook. So I was thinking personally to myself, like, was there some connection there? You know, what role does the fiance play here? And so that was one thing. But I do think that one thing that really did shock a lot of us is that, you know, you have Kevin Jung, who seems like a great guy. You know, he's in a Christian union. He volunteers. He doesn't seem like he would be mixed up in anything that would be questionable or would lead to anything like remotely like this. So we're all still pretty shocked.
And what is the atmosphere like on campus and surrounding areas now that you have this person of interest who is on the run, who is considered armed and dangerous? Are there flyers up? Are people out there exercising caution? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think things have calmed down quite a bit since the original shooting, because it was going on 20 days now that it happened. It's hard to gauge campus right now because everyone is pretty much taking classes remotely. Mm-hmm. And so I think there might be more tension if we were on campus. But I don't want to walk around that area of New Haven alone at night. Like, I wouldn't anyway. It's kind of unfortunate because there have been other incidents since then. You know, nothing like the murder of Kevin Jung, but there have been muggings. And just 2 days ago, groups of men on bikes were going around campus groping women. And so I think these things happen, or like usually just small incidents happen like every now and then, that kind of just add to the succession of events.
So do you have anything else about this that you would like to add?
Yeah, just, you know, obviously, like all of us on campus, you know, not just in the newspaper, are looking forward to seeing what more we can learn about this. Maybe looking forward isn't the right phrase, because this is obviously a tragedy. And, you know, we had lots of shocked people afterwards. And I think we're still shocked. But I think most of all, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're, you know, in journalism, or because you're the person who reports on these things, or if you're just a regular person who's watching these events unfold. I think that we all want the killer to be brought to justice.
So that was my interview with Valerie. Valerie, thank you so much for coming on the pod and sharing your perspective and your findings with us. Brittany, what did you think?
It's going to be really interesting to see how that all unfolds, because there's something going on here that we don't know about. I mean, it's not just a random. There could be a thing. In my, like, first I'm thinking, is he somehow obsessed with Kevin's fiance?
Right. Did he have some kind of unhealthy obsession with her? And, you know, he was intent on getting Kevin Jung out of the picture. We have no idea. Yeah. I guess we will, you know, see what happens from that. Now, since I spoke with Valerie, like I said, there are some updates. An arrest warrant was just filed for Keenswan Pan, and that is for Kevin's murder. So police have obviously likely found more evidence tying Pan to the crime, because there's now a warrant for his arrest. So like you said, we'll have to see what happens with this one. I feel like it's going to be one that even though it's not necessarily fast moving, I feel like there's going to be some fast moving developments in this one soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So a case that I'm following currently is the case of Letitia Staunch. And so she is on trial for the murder of her stepson, who disappeared in January of 2020. And so this caught my eye because last Friday, there was actually an update. For a while, there was a question of if she was competent to stand trial. And so they found that, yes, yeah, she's competent to stand trial. Now she wants to represent herself. And it's always interesting to me when somebody wants to represent themselves, especially for a murder trial. But the reason that it caught my eye is a quote that she had to the judge regarding her representing herself. So she said, "It might sound audacious, but I'm really good at poker. And you know the saying, you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. and I've got a winning hand, an ace in the hole. And it just was a little bit haunting to me. So a little bit of background on this. She was the last person to see her 11-year-old stepson alive. Initially, she said that he went to go play with some friends. She never saw him again. Then, after a little bit of investigation, she said, oh, actually, I was kidnapped, I was raped, and they took my stepson. So obviously, a lot of red flags were raised then. The evidence building against her is fairly strong. She had asked her daughter to buy baking soda and vinegar and carpet cleaner and trash bags, all leading up to her stepson's disappearance. So already this is disturbing when you have children involved. It's very difficult. But just that quote that she had to the judge just felt very sinister to me. And I'm thinking, what ace in the hole do you have? So I will definitely be following this one very closely and keep you guys posted on what happens there.
Definitely. So wait, is he still missing?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hopefully the ace in the hole is that he's alive somewhere.
I hope so.
Probably wishful thinking. So if we have time, I just want to go over this one other case. And I think I texted you about this last week or the week before. It's the Attorney General from South Dakota. And I just feel like I just want to get your take on it and listeners' take on this too.
So this is from the New York Post. The South Dakota Attorney General, Jason Raunsborg, has recently come under fire publicly for a hit-and-run accident that occurred in September 2020. He was driving home around 10:30 p.m. from a political fundraiser when he hit 55-year-old Joseph Beaver, who was walking along the shoulder of the highway. He claims that he looked, didn't see anything. He called 911. Another officer reportedly came. They didn't see anything. And so Raunsborg drove home. He claims that he thought it was just a deer. But the next day, he went back to the scene and said he came across Joseph Beaver's body. Well, last week, he was charged with three misdemeanors in the case: careless driving, operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile electronic device, and veering out of his lane. According to authorities, he was not intoxicated. Now, also last week, authorities released an interview they did with Raunsborg, where they tell him that the victim's glasses were found inside his vehicle, saying that means the victim's face must have gone through the windshield. Raunsborg claimed he hadn't seen the glasses until the police showed them to him. He says he was distracted, looking at his phone, when he hit what he thought was a deer. Here's a snippet from that interview.
So, did you see the glasses right next to that?
I did not.
Okay.
You showed me the glasses the first time.
They're Joe's glasses.
I'm wondering about that.
So that means his face came through your windshield. It's a tough thing.
Oh. I was thinking that his face did not come through because there would have been blood. I thought there'd been blood everywhere. And then now, you know, after I thought about it.
Yeah, and you've had time. Right. His glasses are right there, Jason. Those are Joe's.
I did not see the glasses until you showed me.
Sure. Oh. So the only way for them to get there is through the windshield. At the impact, did you look over and see anything?
I did not see anything. I mean, I was looking to get to the side. I did not see anything. No, absolutely not.
So articles of impeachment have been drafted against him. There have been calls for him to resign. But so far as of this recording, he has not. And his spokesperson has said that he has no plans to do so. So that's quite the job you hold as the Attorney General. And to do something like this that causes the death of somebody else, I mean, even just looking at it from that point, you should definitely resign. Quite shocking that he's not. Also, somebody died and there's just misdemeanors involved here. And if you think that you just hit a deer, why do you go back there the next day? And I mean, maybe there's plausible reasons for all of this. Maybe he really did think he hit a deer. He didn't see anything. But then the next day to return to the scene and then find his body, I don't know. Like, and then the glasses being inside the vehicle, I'm trying to picture how that would have happened. And without you knowing, and I can't. So a lot of questions about this case.
Yeah, for sure. That detail about the glasses is really gut-wrenching. That made me pause for a second.
I know. Horrible. Well, I'm sure that there will be updates in that soon. Hopefully that he, at the very least, resigns.
All right. Well, did you get some listener questions for us?
So I basically just got a few. One was about, can you do an episode on the Netflix documentary, The Staircase, and show what the prosecution presented? Did you see The Staircase?
I've watched it twice. I thought that I needed to watch it twice to digest it. And now, of course, his name escapes me. If you say it, then I'll know it. But the husband, such an interesting character that I think that's what really drew me to it a second time.
Yeah. And that's funny because that's actually a good idea to watch it again. Michael Peterson. I thought it was Michael Peterson, but unfortunately, there's a lot of Petersons who are defendants for killing their wives. So I didn't want to assume. But yeah, Michael Peterson. So The Staircase is one of my all-time favorite documentaries. I just thought it was absolutely fascinating that you could get such a good look into somebody's defense team and how they operate. And I was glued to it. I love that you watched it twice. I feel like I should definitely watch it again. That's not a bad idea.
I think it's worth it to watch it a second time. Just there's a lot that goes on and they really start, you know, they show the entire process. One thing that was very crazy to me is that they continue to show all of their lawyer meetings in this home where it happened with the staircase. Right, you know, in the back of the shots. And it was just very chilling. And I did find it to be interesting how much his family stuck by him. I mean, his kids were so, so devoted to him and his innocence that I liked also watching that dynamic, because I imagine that trials like this, cases like this, tear families apart.
So as to the question of whether or not I would cover it, and I like how they phrase it, and show what the prosecution presented. I think that's actually not a bad idea. Something I will definitely look into and see if there's anything interesting that I could add there.
Yeah, I think it'd be worth it to look at it just strictly from that perspective.
So another question I got was about the Cale Fleischauer case, and they asked did Cale's defense ever bring up state of mind like insanity? And the answer to that is no, they didn't. And I think that's probably because they were maintaining that Cale didn't even shoot the gun. You know, they were saying that Chase likely, whether accidentally or whether he was trying to die by suicide, that Chase was actually the one who shot the gun. So there was no evidence that I saw of anything like that. And then another question I got, and just for transparency, I'm just gonna talk about it, but somebody asked about all the ads I have in my episodes and if there's any way I could put all of the ads in the beginning. And I think that would be a great idea if I was able to do it. However, that's not something that is something that I can control. And I think if you think about it, like you're watching a television show, something on the TV, and you know, they cut to commercial breaks and you kind of fast forward them. And so similar to that, yeah, they kind of have to be throughout the episode. So,
but a good reminder that they can join Patreon and not have to listen to.
Yes, definitely. And the fast forwarding. And I don't want to encourage anybody to fast forward, because if you go to the websites and use the promo codes, you know, that your favorite podcasts or whatever are promoting, you know, it does help them. So just try to deal with them. I'll try to make them more interesting. It's hard.
I don't skip through your ads, Jillian.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. But the funny thing is like I feel like a lot of my ads lately, I genuinely, and I do get to approve all the ads that I do, which is awesome. But I've been like really loving some of them, like absolutely. Just off the top of my head, Magic Spoon. I don't know if you've tried that.
Okay, seriously. I was going to ask you off this episode about Magic Spoon? Is it really good? Because it's all over Instagram.
It's really good. It really is. I mean, it's amazing, especially like their peanut butter one. Their peanut butter one reminds me of my all-time favorite, which was Captain Crunch peanut butter, whatever, that I used to eat when I was little. And it tastes just like that. It's so delicious. My mom loves it. My grandma loves it. I've gotten like everybody into it. So yeah.
But does your daughter approve? That's the real question.
Yes, she does. So the funny thing about that is that Layla will be in an ad on Monday's episode.
Okay, that's adorable.
Uh-huh. It's for another brand that I really like, Uprising.
Okay.
So they have bread and chips and things that are healthy, like they use superfoods. So it really goes along with my, you know, my mild gluten allergy that I have. And so, yeah, so Layla tried the chips and I just so happened to be recording her and she was like, these are my favorite. Or actually, I think my parents were recording her. I don't remember, but these are my favorite. And so I like cut that out and put it in. I was like, oh, there you go.
Baby's first ad. That's so cute. Okay, so last sidebar episode, we talked about, Jillian, your nuance of setting up traps in your home before you go to bed.
Totally and, normal.
Yeah, totally normal, just in case there's an intruder. And so we said, if you have some stories that are similar, send them our way. So did we get any listeners who sent in their court junkie nuances?
We did. So one of our listeners, Tracy, said that a while ago, she had listened to a podcast about a home invasion, and that made her pretty scared, just like I am, that was going to happen to her. And in the podcast, the victim said that she basically installed bells that you see on corner shop doors that jingle whenever somebody enters. And so she put them on her front and back door, and that she would put them on the windows, but her family would probably make fun of her for that. But she said that they're very sensitive. You have to open a door very, very carefully to not make a noise. And she said that everyone, you know, kind of thinks she's funny for doing that, but makes her feel better. She 100% recommends it. I actually think that's a pretty good idea.
I think that's a great idea because somebody cuts power to your home, which could happen if they are an intruder and they disarm your alarm system, which a lot of people have alarm systems now. I know we have chimes on our doors just in case our daughter opens up a door, but you know, those can be turned off. A bell, that's smart. I do like that idea.
Yeah, me too. And someone else just basically said, definitely a true crime fanatic like you all, paranoid, constantly worried about crime too. I think it just makes us more aware of human behavior and our surroundings. I think that's a really good point. It definitely does make me very aware, even though it's a paranoid state of mind to have. And oh man, especially coming through, you know, with a daughter now, I mean, how am I going to be with her? I wish there was a way to keep track of her 24/7, you know?
Ugh. Yeah, I felt that comment. I think that the same goes for me. I really, for my whole life, I've followed true crime, and it does just make me look at everybody and think twice, and not necessarily in a bad way, but just more aware of my surroundings, more aware of people. I oftentimes think, okay, if I were to be interviewed because of a crime, would I be able to tell them, oh yes, I saw this person with, you know, this color hair and this type of car. In fact, this happened to my mom recently. She was in her house and there was a bunch of commotion. It turns out somebody was shot up the street from her. And I believe it was the next day, police came by, knocked on her door, asked her if she saw anything, heard anything. She had not. She was inside. It was really cold out. But it was just one of those moments where you think about people, witnesses, and when they're interviewed, and can you rely on what they're saying? I don't know what I was doing at 2 p.m. yesterday.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, well, it's interesting.
Oh, definitely. Okay. So another confession then along this same line is I just now, again, you do these things and you just think that they're completely normal until we're in a conversation like this. And then I realize maybe not so much. I, at my home office where I work, my computer is like facing the window, like facing the street. So I can basically like see my whole street, my whole neighborhood. And if ever there's a car that like looks suspicious, and I have no criteria for this, if it's just slowing down in front of a house, probably an Uber driver, you know, like looking whatever, or a delivery of some sort, but whatever, if they're like kind of slowing around, if they, you know, I've seen people get out and take pictures of houses before. I will literally take out my phone and take a picture of it. Or if I can see like the license plate, I'll write it down. So literally, if you go through the notes in my phone app, you'll see all these like random things. And like, it's just because in case I was ever questioned, you know, yeah. I got it. Or what I also do, if I have a friend who's taking an Uber, I will write down the license plate of the car they got into, you know, just in case. So I've done that numerous times.
Yes, absolutely. That's very, very smart. Very smart.
Yeah. So this actually leads me to something I want to talk about. I want us to think about and then talk about in Sidebar Episode 3. And that is, true crime obviously has a very, can have a very negative perception, you know, that we like to follow things that involve the worst days of people's lives. And that is absolutely true. And I always like to say I like to follow things like this because I'm interested in the court case aspect of it. I'm interested in how our criminal justice system works. But I just wanted to talk about it and bring this up because I think that along the lines of what we were just saying, there are things that watching true crime and watching these documentaries and listening to these podcasts, there are things that we can do to change that negative perception and use it for good. So I want to kind of think about resource ideas, ways in which we can help get involved. You know, if we're sitting back and we're watching and listening to these things, can we go an extra step and maybe help spread the word on it? Whether it's retweeting about a missing person, or whether we do have $5 that we can put towards helping to solve a case. There's definitely things that I think that we can do. And I think it's probably helpful to come up with a good comprehensive list of such things. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's such a great idea. And I think one really basic thing is going back to the, if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. And what would you do if you were in a situation where you saw someone being attacked or saw someone who looked like they were in trouble? A previous episode, you talked about the waitress who held up the note for the boy. And again, this, like, that gives me chills just bringing that up because it's such a crazy, awesome story. I just want to hug that waitress. Mm-hmm. And we all do that. If we all do that part to look out for our friends, our neighbors, and also strangers, what kind of difference would that make?
And if you don't listen to these types of things, then maybe, you know, maybe you wouldn't necessarily know about it. You know, you wouldn't really think to do that. So I just also noticed that someone had asked if there's any update on that waitress case. So I'm kind of looking it up, and all I can see is that there was a fundraiser for her and thousands was raised for her. So Carvalho says she plans to use some of the money to pay off debt accumulated during the coronavirus shutdown and help her daughters financially. She then plans to start a foundation so others can follow her lead and give a child a second chance at life.
Oh, awesome. So there's just one of the resources. So we'll have to stay tuned to get her foundation information, and hopefully you can post that somewhere, and that can be one step for somebody to do better.
And then Orlando police said the boy who was being abused is doing well and has already put on some weight. Well, thank you so much, Brittany. This was another great episode, I think.
Until next time.
Until next time.